All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2021-1352, Richard Elliott versus Abubakar Durrani, MD, Center for Advanced Spine Technologies, and TriHealth Incorporated, formerly doing business as the Good Samaritan Hospital of Cincinnati. For the appellant, Mr. Herzig.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Aaron Herzig for appellant. I hope to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This is the latest in a series of cases before this court in which it is being asked to imply exceptions and extensions to the true statute of repose for medical malpractice claims as enacted by the General Assembly. The what the court said in Wilson, which is the reason that this case is back here, is that RC 2305.113C, the medical claim statute of repose, has only the exceptions that are expressly stated within that statute. The court has said that the General Assembly, if it intended to have other exceptions to the statute of repose, would have written them within that statute. The court was unequivocal about that, and it was, of course, correct about that, because statutes of repose have a very specific purpose. The purpose of a statute of repose is to end liability for defendants and create certainty in the medical context for the healthcare industry. That was clearly the concern of the General Assembly at the time. Following Wilson, Your Honor.
Counsel, what is a plaintiff to do in circumstances such as this, where the main defendant has absconded?
Your Honor, the plaintiff, first of all, has a statute of limitations that they must meet where they either discover the injury or the doctor-patient privilege ends. But then they get 4 years under the statute of repose, and the General Assembly has been very clear that that 4-year period is a final bar to any claim under the medical repose statute.
So that's 4 years to determine where the defendant is and serve him.
Well, Your Honor, service is irrelevant here in this context. As this court held in Johnson, as the Sixth Circuit held in Garber, the statute, when it was written in 1853, certainly had the purpose of attempting to help Ohioans who were trying to sue somebody who had left the state. We obviously have the rules of civil procedure now. We have service process. And you can, in fact, get service on someone who isn't within the jurisdiction. So we think any issues related to that have been cured by the rules of civil procedure. Excuse me. And of course, this court has been clear that when it applies the absent defendant statute, it doesn't worry about the purpose. The Johnson case from this court said, yep, it's an old statute. Yes, it probably doesn't make sense anymore, but in the statute of limitations context, we will read the words as they are written. But you're absolutely right, Your Honor. It doesn't seem to be a statute that is fit for modern litigation. And of course, in this context, the trial counsel in the Durrani cases has not raised the failure of service for dismissal purposes or anything like that. So it's of no moment here. The other important piece, I think, Your Honors, is that, of course, the rule that the First District wrote doesn't just apply to the medical claim statute of repose. It would, in fact, apply to all of the repose statutes enacted by the General Assembly. So you'd be opening indefinite liability to construction claims, products liability claims, now medical or legal malpractice claims, along with medical malpractice claims.
But if that were the case, wouldn't that be the onus be on the defendant? Wouldn't that be the defendant's fault? The absent defendant?
Certainly the absent defendant's action triggers the absent defendant statute under the statute of limitations. So if we're assigning fault, I guess it's the defendant's action that triggers the statute. But the statute has never been written, as far as we can tell, to apply to a statute of repose. Certainly when it was written in 1853, there were no statutes of repose. The General Assembly only could have been talking about periods of limitation, meaning statutes of limitation. And we don't think that any of the changes to either the absent defendant statute, which mostly have been ministerial, changing gendered terms to non-gendered terms, have affected the meaning of that statute as it was originally intended. The statute of repose, on the other hand, was amended to include specific exceptions. In sections C and D of 2305.113C, the General Assembly created a very specific statutory scheme. First, it said, 2305.16 applies to extend the statute of repose. That's for minors, people of unsound mind, disability. So the fact that it included that general savings provision suggests that it was, in fact, excluding any other savings provisions. It's exactly what this court held in Wilson. The other thing they did, if you look at D, they create a very specific scheme for for extending the statute of repose. If you discover an injury in the third year of the statute, you can get more time. If you discover a foreign body in your late in the repose period, you can get more time. Now, interestingly, the General Assembly says that a plaintiff must prove that by clear and convincing evidence, the highest standard we have in civil cases. So I think it's pretty clear that the General Assembly wasn't messing around here. The General Assembly means the statute of repose to cut off liability for defendants in the medical context 4 years after the occurrence. I would also say that in the Wilson case and Antoon before it, this court wasn't messing around. It sent a very clear message to litigants and to the General Assembly. If you're writing a statute of repose and you want the time periods to be extended or changed, put it in the statute of repose. That's what this.
How do you reconcile that RC 2305-15A includes the statute of the absent defendant statute specifically includes RC 2305-113, which is the statute of repose, for its applicable period of limitation that's told?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misunderstand which statutes you're referring to.
The RC 2305-15A, which is the absent defendant statute, expressly has 2305.113C in its list of applicable limitations periods that it applies to.
I apologize. Yes, Your Honor. So 2305.113C is only specifically referenced in subsection B about imprisonment. But we concede that 2305.113 is within the list of statutes listed in A. So A says 2305.04 to 2305.14, which is the entire list of all statutes of limitations within the civil context. We think very simply, Your Honor, that that the language of the absent defendant statute makes clear that it is dealing with periods of limitation. As I mentioned before, it was enacted when only limitations periods existed. It has been largely unchanged during the time that
repose periods are referred to as limitation periods.
The
plaintiff is limited from bringing a cause of action after certain period of time, without exceptions. Mm-hmm. And case law has referred to statutes of repose as limitation periods.
Yes, there are times, I think, when the language is used loosely, Your Honor. I think when you look at, first of all, again, I think the words that this court has held in Wilson apply to this case and end it. But if you want to look at the statutory construction of 2305.15 itself, there are a number of indications that it is applying only to statutes of limitations. The first one is that it deals in terms of accrual. The time periods listed in 2305.15A are marked by when a statute accrues. Accrual is the language of statutes of limitations because, of course, statutes of repose can run, as this court held in Antoon, before a claim ever accrues. In fact, the main purpose of a statute of repose is to cut off a limitations period, to end the discovery rule, to, in fact, make sure that some claims do not accrue after that time. So we think that's an important indication. And we think when the General Assembly has been writing statutes, the period of limitation language has been applied in the statute of limitations context and not in the repose context.
So if someone commits a malpractice or some injury on a person and flees the country, that person can arguably come back after 4 years and not have to face any liability. Do you think the legislature intended to have potential or to have viable medical claims disappear with a defendant just leaving and not being able to be held responsible?
So I don't actually think that's what happens, Your Honor, because, of course, if someone stays and an injury isn't discovered within 4 years, that injury has never accrued and is therefore not subject to the statute of limitations, and the statute of repose has cut it off.
But let's say it accrues.
So, what's interesting, to finish answering your first question, that is how it operates. It sometimes has effects that people might feel is unjust, but in the General Assembly's balance of policy, it decided that cutting off these claims after 4 years is more important. The other thing, and we have this in these cases, is that you can still proceed with a lawsuit, you can still get service, even through publication with permission of the court, which happens all the time, and proceed with a lawsuit. In fact, in these cases, the plaintiff's counsel will ask for an adverse inference instruction now saying the defendant isn't here, you can infer that if he were, there would be bad testimony against him. So flight, I don't think, has the impact of preventing cases from moving forward. And I apologize, I forgot the second part.
And in that instance, but of course you're hit with the defense of statute repose, you're hit with the defense of necessary parties, et cetera. I mean, could the General Assembly have intended or envisioned that this not having the absent defendant statute apply could conceivably thwart?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it did. I think the General Assembly has been clear that if it wants an exception to apply, we'll write it into the statute. That's what it did with 2305.16 and the detailed scheme in Section D. And that's what this court, again, has said in Wilson, which is that if you want there to be an exception, be clear with us. Tell us in the statute of repose. And that's because they do intend these claims to be cut off after 4 years.
But do you call, and it's my final question for you, do you call reading these sort of statutes together or in peri materia the same as having to find an exception? I mean, are you saying that the exceptions delineated in the statute are the only way in which the statute of repose can be understood or interpreted or applied, and that they can't be read with any other statute?
Not unequivocally, Your Honor, although I think this court has been unequivocal about it. This court has said, and I think it's important to draw these bright lines for the General Assembly, for the industry, for litigants. If the statute of repose is to be extended in any way, put it in the statute of repose. The other pieces to look at, I think, in terms of statutory interpretation are the statute of repose is the later in time statute, which prevails under that canon. It is the more specific statute. It has a detailed scheme for when the repose is to be extended, another mark in its favor when you're looking at canons of construction. If the statute would be superfluous if read the way the First District did, because that exception in 2305.16 would be unnecessary if, in fact, you could simply imply general saving statutes to apply to the statute of repose. And finally, the fact that there is that exception suggests that other exceptions do not apply. Your Honor, I see I've used most of my time.
Yes.
I'd like to reserve the rest, if I may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Statman?
Chief Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Alan Stapman, and I will tell you, I've been practicing 39 years of my first time here. I'm also that trial counsel that appellant counsel referred to, because I have tried 53 straight Durrani jury trials. And I don't know that counsel's representations of what goes on at the trial are really accurate, nor are they really before the court today. But if there are any issues, I've been there for 4.5 years in the courtroom and tried 53 of these cases, one after the other after the other. In this particular matter, though, we're not looking at what went on in a trial. We're looking at this statute of repose issue. And as you, as a court, have pointed out, that the U.S. Supreme Court likens a statute of repose to giving the physician a fresh start, similar to how the bankruptcy code does. You cited that case. And I find that interesting, having done a lot of bankruptcy law over my career. The bankruptcy code operates from the basis of good faith. And it has exceptions in 523 and 747, which are exceptions to discharge. And those exceptions deal with bad conduct. And courts have uniformly talked about the fact that the statute of repose is a privilege for these physicians not to be abused. And one of the reasons I believe that the legislature has put the statute in place related to absconding is because the legislature expects the court to apply that so that people that abuse their privilege of having litigation cut off do not get that advantage over the litigant. And so you have 0.15 that talks about when a defendant has absconded. There was some discussion just a few minutes ago about service of process. I will tell you that at the trial level, the courts have routinely ruled in my favor that trying to subpoena Dr. Durrani to trials is futile and will not be required. And he was served in those cases. He's in those cases, and that's different than what we're here talking about today. And in this particular case, we don't have ambiguities to get into statutory construction. And I might note that the appellant's brief, at first blush, talks about Wilson is totally irrelevant to this conversation. Yet I heard a lot of Wilson, Wilson, Wilson. And the issue that I see is that Wilson was dealing with a savings statute. Completely different issue. It's not a statute of limitations. It's not a statute of repose. It's a set of circumstances that give an exception that allows a refiling if you meet the criteria. Now, what did you say in Antoun? In Antoun, you said that the statute dealing with savings relates back to the original filing. But then in Wilson, you said that that was dicta in Antoun, and that can be ignored based upon the circumstances and facts before us because dicta isn't binding. So what does counsel do? Counsel first says Wilson's irrelevant, then talks about different elements related to the savings statute, and then points to where you all said in the decision that, well, in Wilson, you said, and let me add the words, in dicta, that it's got to be enumerated. But that wasn't what was going on in that case. That was a comment made. But in the specific examination of this case, just like the difference in Antoun and Wilson led the Wilson decision to say dicta from a previous case is not important to our decision and is not binding, that same thing should apply here. Wilson was a specific statute, saving statute, not a repose, and not a statute of limitations. This whole argument about accrual isn't an argument at all, because if you go to the other tolling statutes. They talk about an action that hasn't accrued and an action that has accrued, and how the statute of repose operates either to extinguish the claim that never existed or extinguish the claim that was actually there in front of them.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time understanding how the statement in Wilson that because RC 2305.113C now expressly incorporates only one statutory exception, other statutes that extend the time in which to bring an action must necessarily be excluded. That doesn't seem like that's dicta. That seems to be the essence of the holding of the case.
Well, no, it isn't, because the 2305.19 isn't related. That case was all about the savings statute.
Yeah, I understand that, but this says other statutes that extend the time in which to bring an action must necessarily be excluded. It's not limited just to the savings statutes.
No, I understand, but that wasn't the holding in the case, because 2305.19 is not part of the tolling statute itself.
But it's the rationale for the holding, I guess, is maybe a better way to put it. Isn't that the core rationale for the holding?
No, I don't see it that way. What I see is that the court held that 2305.19 extinguished, when it's voluntarily dismissed, leaves the claim as having never occurred. It has accrued, but it has never occurred. And canceled out Antoon's talk about relation back to when it was dismissed, and said this is wholly a new filing outside of the tolling statute. No one in Wilson was talking about the effect of 0.15. Nothing in Wilson talked about absconding. Now, had that been part of the appeal when the case was argued in the first district, which it wasn't part of that appeal, and it wasn't what the court accepted in Wilson to review, that might be a different story. But the court specifically left for another day how the tolling statute would be affected by flight, and made it very clear that 2305.19 is not part of the statutory scheme of 113 or 0.15.
How do you deal with your colleague's argument that because 113C expressly identifies and excludes 2305.16, you know, the tolling due to minority or unsound mind, that it knows how to create an exception when it wants to. It created a exception for a tolling statute, yet, as your colleague argues, that indicates one of two things, that either that indicates they did not want to exclude 2305.15, and or excluding 116 is unnecessary because it basically has the same language as 1.5.
Well,
I mean, do you have an answer to that problem?
Well, in my practice, there's always a door number three. Kind of like that show, Let's Make a Deal. Is it door number one, two, or three? You described door number one or door number two, but door number three is still an active door. And that statute, 0.15, incorporates 113 into it. And as I understand the history, the judicial history and the legislative history of what happened with minority, is way back, minority was caught up in the 4 years, and the court ruled that was unconstitutional. And the statute got amended because the court was talking about minority, and so minority got dragged into the statute by the legislature to solve the problem of the unconstitutionality of the statute of repose as applied to minors. So if you look back at the history as to how this all got put in the hopper and formulated, it got dragged in because of a problem. And maybe 1-5 will get dragged in because of the decision that you make in this case that it's applicable. And if the legislature doesn't want it applicable, they'll put in an exclusion. But these statutes, they're not ambiguous. And so this whole idea that they're arguing legislative history and statutory construction, those to me are somewhat of a desperate grasp, because if you follow the logic of the appellant, 0.15 has no meaning as it relates to statutes of repose. And that cannot be. It cannot be. And I'll tell you why. My father, a physician, retired, 91 years old, always got the legal answer right by applying fundamental concepts of logic, philosophical concepts of logic. When you apply philosophical concepts of logic, that's what the law ultimately is about. And it is not logical, as was asked, that we're going to let Dr. Durrani, who fled the country under indictment without a passport, stay in Pakistan for 4 years and get out of, at this point I have $155 million in verdicts against him.
Counsel.
Yes.
Over on the other side.
Oh, I'm
here.
Sorry.
aside from all of that, I mean, we can't create a results-oriented decision. We've got to look at what's going on here with the interpretation of the statute. And aside from the obvious suffering that's gone on here, my question is, when in any other case have you seen the plain language of the statute that says this group of statutes between 2305.4 to 2305.14, with name some others, where there's leave the state, abscond, conceal self, you've got a tolling that happens. When have you seen a situation where, for that to actually apply, the other statute that's contained within that range of statutes has to have a corresponding reference to the tolling statute? Is there any other situation you know of in the law of statutory construction where there's this qualifier for the simple language of the statute to apply?
But 0.15, interestingly, is not recited in any statute. It's not referenced in any single statute of limitations or statute of repose, because it, in and of itself, and the statutory construction of 115 tells us what it applies to.
I understand, I think we're extrapolating Wilson. That's for my analogy there. Go ahead.
Well, when you say, have I seen it, I don't know that we would be here today have we all seen how this works without ultimately percolating up to this level. So obviously we've got two different points of view, and I'm sure my door number three applies and there'll be your point of view as well. But I see that statute, 0.15, as being instructional as to what it applies to. Therefore, it is not necessary for the statutes that are in that net under 1-5 to then recognize it one way or another.
That's my question. Thank you.
Well, okay, thank you. So obviously I see this completely different than the appellant. I think that when you look at the First District's case, it has done, the court has done a tremendous amount of work in that decision, looking at the legislative history, going back to the 1850s, working it up through, talking about balancing all of the issues that are presented by both the appellant and the appellee in this case. And I'm not asking for a result-oriented decision. I'm merely pointing out that logic, that the Durrani case is the extreme, okay? So I'm not asking for this result because it's Dr. Durrani. I'm just demonstrating to the court, I hope, that the reason that we deal with absconding, and that's a serious word, absconding defendants, is because they can spiral out of control to the level this has. And I'm not saying to you, Your Honor, make my people whole. I'm saying logic doesn't dictate this kind of result. Yes, will it be inconvenient once in a while because some doctor may have to talk about his vacation in deciding whether 4 years ran or not? Well, compared to the harm, I think the doctors who want that good faith use of the tolling statute, and actually lawyers too, because it's been extended, lawyers now have a tolling statute, that they're going to operate in good faith. They're going to answer those questions. They're going to deal with it and understand, just like in bankruptcy, you got to lay a lot of cards on the table to get to the discharge. And I think you've got to lay a lot of cards on the table to avoid the tolling of the statute of repose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've saved a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me clarify a few things. First of all, I don't understand the idea that we didn't address Wilson. We start our opening brief with the words, less than 2 years ago in Wilson versus Durrani. Wilson is mentioned four times in that first page. And then our opening argument, our first heading, applying this court's unambiguous decision in Wilson, the absent defendant statute cannot toll the medical claim statute of repose. My argument today has been consistent with all our briefing, as I'm sure you have seen. The idea that paragraph 38 of Wilson is dicta, this is a true statute of repose, a fascinating term that this court now has used multiple times with regard to the statute of repose. We don't say it's a true murder statute or a true fraud statute. The point this court has made over and over again is the statute of repose is specific, detailed, and is intended to cut off liability. So it's not something that we imply exceptions to. Something else this court said in Wilson. There is no doubt, and Justice Bruder, this I think answers the question that you have. Yes, those this section is referenced within 2305.15a. It's within the range there. But statutes of repose are in fact different, and this court has said so over and over again. The rule for this court, for Ohio, for the General Assembly when it is writing laws, is to make it abundantly clearly and unambiguously within the statute of repose, so that there isn't any question about whether we're implying or bringing in any new conduct. The last thing I'll say briefly is that 2305.15 includes the words out of state. It doesn't have anything to do with intent. That's what this court has said in Johnson and the Sixth Circuit has said in Garber. In Johnson, a couple that allegedly caused an accident had a lawsuit filed 2 days after the statute of limitations typically would have run. In discovery, they find out that this couple had vacationed in Kentucky for 10 days. That extends the statute of limitations, even though they obviously weren't absconding. And in fact, the dissent in Johnson, Justice Resnick at the time, said, wait a minute, we should have some intent here. And the court said no, and that's what the Sixth Circuit has said as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. The First District decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Before the two judges leave, I was negligent in introducing them for the first case. They were sitting for Justice DeWine and Justice Fisher. We had Judge Bill Klatt from the 10th District Court of Appeals and Judge Scott Gwynn from the 5th District sitting for Justice Fisher.